just one exactly. The principle of statism being so strong still, I was thinking, is this a big hindrance for entry into the European Union? Because for being here in the European Union, we are discussing entry with Turkey, is if at all the hindrance is human rights question. So is this a problem? Because I mean, there's a lot of privatization going on, and rights of privatization from the European Union. But I mean, so this status would be a hindrance. Is this discussed at all? And the discussion concerning has now moved away from wanting to be part of the European Union and away from the European Union to be part of the EAS. Is that still that? Yes.
Thank you for your question. The Kavala's principle of statism is definitely a challenge towards the EU process and, you know, liberalization of Turkey, but other principles as well. I mean, nationalism is also a very big problem. Secularism is a problem as well. And for example, secularism principle does not only, you know, limit the Muslim conservative practice of the majority, it also limits the minority. For example, Christians in Turkey have a problem with the secularism principle as well. For example, the Halki Seminary of the Ecumenical Patriarchate cannot be opened because Turkish law doesn't allow any religious school, period. Religious schools can only be run by the government, and the graduates of those schools can only go to a theology faculty, that's by law. So you cannot have any private religious school. Muslims can't have it, and Christians can't have it either. So secularism problem principle is a problem for everybody, like all religious denominations and all different religions. So you need to liberalize all these principles, that's for sure. As for Kemalism, I mean, there are, I think, two types of Kemalists. There are what I call the progressive Kemalists, who would say Atatürk the best in his time, and now we are at a different age. We should take his basic idea of modernization and move on. They would be more open and supportive, open to and supportive of the EU process. But the more common Kemalism is what I call the literalist Kemalism, which says Atatürk said this, period. You know, that's his golden, you know, era, and the wisdom we get there is like eternal. That is definitely an obstacle to the EU process. And about the mood in Turkey, about the EU, still there's a strong demand in Turkey to enter the EU. But Turks are a little bit disillusioned because they think Europeans don't want Turkey inside the EU, especially some Europeans. So I think the enthusiasm in Turkey for joining the EU has been a little bit curbed by the fact that some European countries, most notably France, and to a degree Germany and Austria, don't look as if they will ever want Turkey to join the Union.
This is a question about how it was before the summit, but also the one before. Can you speculate about the influence of Kemalism in other parts of the Middle East as a idea of the right-wing nation state should be?
Well, Kemalism has been imitated in a few countries, most notably Iran. In the 20s, the Shah of Iran was a great fan of Atatürk, and he wanted to implement some of his reforms in Iran. He even went too extreme. Like, he ordered his police to rip women off from their veils on the streets. Turkey never went as far as that one. What you got in return in Iran was Khomeini. So this dichotomy between a very strict enforced secularism and a traditional religious identity created all sorts of conflicts and rifts in different countries. In Tunisia, for example, there was Bourguiba. He was also like inspired by the Kemalist idea. He was just, you know, showing up on TV, drinking lemonade in Ramadan and telling his people not to fast during Ramadan because it makes them lazy, but national efficiency requires more work and so on. So this idea of imposed modernity created, you know, a reaction on the other side. And I think it has not been fully implemented in any other country. And I don't advise them, they advise that they should. But it also has given a bad name for the idea of secularism. I mean, I make a distinction between secularism and secularity, and I'm in favor of secularity of the state, like a neutral state. But the idea that you can separate the state from religion came to the Islamic world only in the Kemalist sense. It meant that you should ban religious practice, you know, like close down religious schools, you know, ban headscarf and so on. That just created, I think, more reactionary attitudes towards any sort of modernization. So in that sense, it might have been like a factor which contributed to even the rise of radicalism in some parts of the Middle East.
I don't really have anything to add. I was just going to mention that that Ataturk's reforms were explicitly copied by the Pahlavi dynasty in Iran. So I would agree with among others, but I would agree with everything that Rocco said, including the dangers of that kind of modern.
Krishna, I would ask, it's actually going to be very important to you. What exactly is the Islamic world do we consider to be the proper role of King Mustafa as the founder of Turkey? Have everything in mind, he is not a flaker like Barack Obama or immediate creation. He's a man who saved the country from extinction at the end of World War I. He rebuilt the country from very little as a state of dissolution when he took it over and placed his imprint on it. And it could not be a George Washington who would save the United States because we didn't have the same Anglo-Saxon traditions here. Obviously, both of you in similar lives embrace a different model of Turkey. But what would be the role of the founder of King Mustafa in Turkey, and the kind of Turkey that the Turkey did? What do you think?
Okay. Well, I think first we should note that Mustafa Kemal was the leader of the National War of Liberation to, you know, save the country. But he was not the creator of that war. And there were other, like, generals, other, you know, people who collaborated with him. Even before he started the war, you know, there were local organizations in Anatolia to defend the country from invasion. And there was actually the Congress of those local, you know, groups to defend the country from invasion. And Mustafa Kemal came. And then they said, yeah, you're a good leader. You know, you're a good general. You can be our leader. But so that was not, he was not just the creator of because that kind of myth-making is very powerful in Turkey, that everybody was in vain and sleeping and he came and shone us on the nation like a sun, which was not the case. But definitely he was the number one leader there. The thing is, after the War of Liberation, what happened was that Ataturk in the parliament, because the Ottoman Empire had a parliament, I mean, you know, parliament with all sorts of members. Some parliament members sympathized with his political views. They formed the People's Republican Party in 1923, which still lives on as the Kemalist Party. And his opponent, the people who didn't agree with him, main people who were either more religiously conservative or politically liberal, formed this liberal conservative alliance and formed the Progressive Party, Terakki Parvartırka, as it's called in Turkish, in 1924. So there was just two-party system evolving. What happened was that Ataturk closed down the other party just 6 months later and established a single-party rule for 25 years. So then imposed his own ideology on the state as the only truth. I think he would have been done a much better job if he didn't ban opposition. And he just started his life as a politician and, you know, do his best for the country while allowing opposition to criticize him. And then maybe we would have got rid of some of the excesses of the Kemalist revolution. Because there were all sorts of, I mean, since there was no criticism against it in the 30s, the revolution really got out of hand. I mean, they created race theories that Turks were the supreme Aryan race and everything came from Turkishness, you know, in 10,000 years ago and all those things. I think that would have been a much more balanced political system.
Yeah, I largely agree. I would only want to add that, first of all, I certainly would never presume to, in addressing your question, I would never presume to take the position of offering any, being a crass or didactic enough to try to tell the Turkish people what kind of country they ought to have or what sort of political arrangements they ought to make. So I just want to make that very clear at the outset. But also, I think that just to add to something Mr. Akgul brought up, Mustafa Kemal is coming out of a very long tradition of a state-directed modernizing reform. And in an interesting way, your paper kind of ended in an interesting way with a centralizing project of Ottoman intellectuals and military men, highly influenced by positivism, by Comte. That had this, and they weren't alone in that. Similar things were happening elsewhere in the world, South America especially. So this was a sort of in the air, this kind of state-directed, guided kind of modernization. So that's just one other kind of extra point I wanted to mention to you. Also, last year, actually, at this very meeting, I gave a paper about one of these sort of alternate visions or voices for Turkey, Mehmet Cavit Bey, who was very interested in Adam Smith and Bastiat.
He was executed by Mustafa Kemal.
So there was, I think, a different kind of... I think that there was an interesting historical moment that for one reason or another was missed. The other thing that I'm very glad you pointed out was that the Ottoman Empire did have a parliament. It had a constitution. So there was material there on which to build some sort of a republic.
One symbolic effort of the Kemalist revolution is the hat revolution of 1925. By law, bowler hat was made compulsory, and fez was outlawed, and people were executed.
A hat with a brim.
A hat with a brim, and people were executed for not wearing it. So I mean, we didn't need to have that revolution today. Nobody wears any sort of hat in Turkey. But some of the excesses could have been, I think, avoided if it was a system with some opposition allowed, but all opposition was crushed.
Thank you very much. I think both folks might ask you to fascinate my questions to Peter. And you mentioned that in the 19th century, there was a growing centralization of the state, which reduced the, which is the polycentric law system that existed in the Ottoman Empire, and which was actually more than the free minute, because you had all the Catholic nations that had their own law, the French, the Venetian, the English, and so on. So it was really high polycentric. But what do you make of the reforms of the Tensina in the 1830s and so on, which were, I would have thought, very progressive? So I'd say that there was, on one end, a kind of centralization of the legislative process, but was it not, at the same time, a kind of liberalization of the law?
And as a matter of fact, that's exactly the kind of question that Dr. Guthrie was hinting at, I think, and what you were grappling with in your presentation. The Tanzimat reforms are the beginning around 1839 or so was one manifestation of this 19th century movement to centralize and then ultimately modernize the empire. And yes, in some ways you can look at those reforms. One could look at those reforms as being very progressive. The people, the Ottoman statesmen and intellectuals who initiated them, saw themselves as progressive reformers, as did the Kemalists. So my point actually wasn't so much to make any normative judgments about the actual whether these things were progressive or not or anything like that. I was just interested in exploring how the process of centralizing power to the state and actually centralizing and codifying these different previously existing legal structures end up creating exactly the opposite of what the reformers had in mind. So if I'm understanding your question correctly, and by the way, the point about the capitulations is a very good one, and I didn't bring that up because I thought that would have muddied the waters a little too much in what already was probably too ambitious project for such a short presentation. But the point, again, I was trying to make wasn't necessarily to say that these reforms were progressive or not, but rather to point out perhaps the inherent dangers of this kind of modernization or reform directed centrally by a sort of self-proclaimed group of reformers using the coercive power of the central government.
Yes, thank you. I grew up with a tradition that regarded the Ottoman state as an absolute arbitrary despotism, and it was celebrated with the effort of the Greeks and the Bulgarians to cast off the chains of certain servitude. Now, that doesn't seem to be entirely according to the facts, and I'm aware of what you did with that. What is that Greece throughout most of its history in the country is the seat of the verge of being the failed state. And the Greeks who remained in the Greeks in this area were considerably more prosperous than Greeks in Greece itself. However, is the tradition of which about living in which I grew up in its final form? It's a question of the philosopher. Kamala has heard many people so that the libertarian I would probably not have been one of the greatest fans of the Russian place first. But he did use a constitutional state from which both of them were possible. So is the tradition within which I grew up of the onward state and the absolute power of indebtedness. It's highly false, or is there something there?
Well, thank you for the question. I think the truth is always somewhere in between the extremes, and I think let me give you one example. The Greeks rebelled against the Ottoman Empire, like the Serbs, because they believed that they had a national homeland, and they did, and they wanted to liberate it. The Jews never did rebel against the Ottoman Empire. They actually loved the Ottoman Empire to the end, because Jews didn't proclaim a national homeland. Well, Zionism did at some point, but the Jews of the Ottoman Empire were actually fearful that the empire would collapse, and you know they would be left to the mercy of these Russian, Bulgarian, you know, Slavic, you know, Christians coming from the Balkans. So I think I would say my Dr. Menzel is definitely a much more bigger expert on Ottoman history than I am. But my sense about the Ottoman Empire was that until the 19th century, you didn't have national rebellions like the Serbian and the Greek ones because there was no idea of a nation. And so I think the Serbs and the Greeks and the Bulgarians did relatively well under the Ottoman Empire, especially at the time, because the Ottomans did not have a policy of forced conversion. And they just let those people live according to their norms, unless there was a rebellion or something. In the 19th century, with the French Revolution, you know, the idea of a state for every nation became widespread and it started to come to the empire. So in the western parts of the empire, the Greeks said, well, we have been under Turkish yoke for 500 you know, years or 400 years. But they didn't think that way a century ago because they didn't think themselves as a people. So that consciousness, I think, brought the disintegration of the empire. And that consciousness also made the Turks more and more nationalistic and suspicious of the minorities among them, which led to the catastrophe of the Armenians in 1915, the great massacres and, you know, expulsion of the Armenians, which was a product of the fall of the empire, not the empire itself. I mean, the crumbling empire created that disaster. As for Atatürk, actually, he did not bring a constitutional state. The constitutional state was there. I mean, the Ottoman Empire accepted a constitution in 1876.
And in 1908.
In 1908, there was a second, you know, like period of constitutional monarchy. he created a new constitution in 1924, which was interestingly less liberal than the one in 1920. For example, it brought the definition of Turkishness into the constitution, and also it gave the parliament, which he dominated, full powers, all the powers to try. And so there were like tribunals to just deal with the enemies of the revolution, and many people were executed, like Javid Bey, who was a libertarian. So he brought a constitution. I mean, constitution. You should look at the content of the constitution. Right now, we have a constitution again made by the Kemalist generals, which still blocks Turkey's modernization in different ways. My view is this: Mustafa Kemal Atatürk was definitely a modernizer, no doubt about that. But modernity sometimes can be a good thing. Sometimes can be a not very good thing. And that depends on, I think, the authoritarianness or the, you know, liberalness of that modernity. And in Atatürk's time, I think the authoritarian side was much more emphasized.
Again, I don't have too much to add, except it might be of interest, especially to some people in the room, to note that the Ottoman constitution of 1876 that was then reinstated in 1908 was almost word for word a translation of the Belgian constitution. So whatever one thinks of the Belgian constitution, that was 1830, I guess. But that was the constitution the Ottoman Empire used, was basically the Belgian constitution. Again, I don't have too much to add, except to say that that one of the things I was trying to explore in my own remarks was in a way your question, but also the points that Mr. Akhil brought up, that I think that what happens in the 19th century is an interesting combination of these foreign ideas of romantic nationalism and the Enlightenment coming in from students the Ottoman Empire had sent to Europe. They bring these ideas back. And what's interesting is they find in the Milets, which were basically established in the 19th century, these sort of ready-made vehicles for the transmission of these ideas. So they convert these institutions, the Millet institutions, really into embryonic national states or national projects. It's also interesting that the Ottoman authorities wanted the Millets to have constitutions even before the Ottoman Empire itself officially had one in the 1860s. And these constitutions were written generally not by the clerics, but by these young nationalists coming back from Europe, who then used the constitutions of these Millets as a way of basically thinking about them as in national terms as opposed to religious terms. And then once you start thinking about nations, then of course they need a state, they need a homeland, right? They need a state. I'm not sure how to answer the other part of your question. You know, I did say that I wasn't trying to, I'm not, there certainly were all sorts of abuses in all of these systems. So I'm not trying to say that, like some people do, by the way, say that the Ottoman Empire, especially under Sultan Suleiman, was some kind of interfaith paradise, and everyone, went on hugging one another all day, and it surely wasn't. And there surely were built into the system various kinds of power relationships, in part based on religion. What I thought was so interesting from some of these court cases is that it suggested that the segregation between the communities was not nearly as powerful as been imagined. The mass of oppressed Christians kind of groaning under an unmitigated Ottoman tyranny. And it also suggested that there were some Christians in this world, this pre-19th century Ottoman world, who were pretty powerful, who could stand up to powerful Muslims in the establishment and win in the Sharia court. So again, I'm not sure if I'm entirely answering your question, but
Interesting point I just want to add upon to your actually speech, which was very good about Sharia and sometimes Christians finding Sharia useful. In the ninth Ottoman Sultan, Yavuz Sultan Selim, who was Yavuz the Grim, heavy-handed Sultan, and he did some massacres of Shiites in the east and so on. He, at some point, decided to convert all Christians to Muslims so he can rule the empire better, more neat empire, everybody. The Sheikh al-Islam said, you can't do this. This is against the Sharia. Sir, there because there has been time because it is forced conversion is not, you know, it's banned in the Quran actually. I mean, there's another problem about apostasy, but you know, forced conversion is not an Islamic practice. So this was one thing that I just want to add. And the second thing is when the Ottomans gave equal citizenship rights to Christians and Jews in 1856, the Islahat Ferman, and this was the second step after Tanzimat, because before then they were second-class citizens. They were protected, the Zimmis, but they would not have the equal rights. Some Christians didn't like it because it also meant that now they have to serve in the military. Before that, they were just paying a lot of some extra tax, but they were, you know, free from military service.
Not to quibble, but no one was a citizen. There were no citizens at all.
Well, no so citizen, but citizen. equal okay, rights.
But it's just a, yeah. Because it implies a kind of a different kind of constitutional democratic order.
Okay, sorry. So, I defer to your wisdom on that. Yeah, but equality was brought to all citizens, equal like things, and that include the, I mean, taxes were equal, and they had to serve in the military like Muslims did. But, you know, some were not happy about that. So the system had sometimes advantages and disadvantages. And also, that was the system. But otherwise, I mean, you had a like a tough sultan who just, you know, there was a rebellion and they, you know, like suppressed rebellion with very bloody methods. That's something else. But I think the general system or, I mean, to use it very, you know, like a pejorative way, the system was, I think, relatively preferable to non-Muslims. And that's why especially Jews prefer the Ottoman Empire.
In fact, even the military service was so unpopular that the Ottoman authorities had to institute a special tax that was available only to the Christians that they could buy them, and Jews that they could buy themselves out of the military service.
Yeah.
Okay, last question. How terrible
the
role of the Taliban in the question.
Well, that's a very this is a political question, if I will, a good question. Thank you. I don't think so. I mean, first of all, the caliphate is it's a political institution. And it was established after the Prophet died, and you know, Muslims by arbitration they said let's have a successorship, and it went on. It's unlike like the role of the Pope in Catholicism. It's not that integral to the faith. I mean, if you don't have a caliphate, you're just totally lost. I mean, it's not that way. It was more of a political role than a religious role. And when he abolished it, I think it had bad consequences in the sense of like leaving the Sunni world totally chaotic. But I don't see in the like future any like chance of establishing the caliphate because it was just transmitted. But now, how do you reestablish it? I mean, the best thing the Muslim world could establish was the Islamic conference, the organization of the Islamic conference. But I don't think anyone has the authority right now to say, I'm establishing it here. But they will say, who are you? I mean, so I think we will be in a chaotic world in that sense. For the foreseeable future.
Thank you. Very interesting.
Yeah. It's a very new concern.